Welcome to VOA's International Edition for Friday, August 21st, 2015. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up today, a former president begins his battle with cancer.
They did an MRI and found that there were 4 spots of melanoma on my brain.
The UN Atomic Energy Agency defends its inspection plans for Iran. Greece's prime minister steps down. And we'll celebrate 75 years of music at the Tanglewood Festival. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter says the tests on a mass removed from his liver reveal that he has melanoma, a type of skin cancer, that has spread from his liver to his brain. At an afternoon news conference in Atlanta, Georgia, the former president said he would begin radiation treatment immediately.
They are fairly small spots, about 2 millimeters, if you can envision what a millimeter is. And then I understand I'll have 4 treatments scheduled at 3-week intervals.
There had been much speculation in the worldwide press about Mr. Carter's health since the initial August 12th announcement that he was battling cancer. The disease was found after doctors had removed a mass from his liver, but a later MRI revealed the cancer in his brain. The 39th president said that he was surprised by how at ease he was with the news, especially when he looked back on his life.
But I was surprisingly at ease. You know, I've had a wonderful life. I've had thousands of friends, and I've had an exciting and adventurous and gratifying existence. So I was surprisingly at ease, much more so than my wife was.
President Carter said that he was surprised that he did not despair or get angry when he received his diagnosis. He said he is, quote, ready for anything and looking forward to a new adventure. For some perspective on Jimmy Carter's announcement and his legacy, my colleague Sarah Williams spoke with VOA's Kane Farabaugh, who has interviewed the former president several times and has done several reports on his life after the presidency.
He did say he's going to cut back on a lot of his schedule and activities related with the Carter Center, but he also then also indicated that he hopes to continue teaching Sunday school at his church in Plains, something he has done every weekend that he is home for most of his post-presidency. And so there are some things about his schedule, his routine, and his life that he hopes will remain as usual. But then, you know, another very dramatic another part of that will be that he's going to cut down a lot of his schedule related to work with the Carter Center. And that also includes uncertainty about whether or not he'll participate in the Habitat for Humanity Build project later this year in Nepal, which he was scheduled to do the first week of November.
Kane, you've interviewed President Carter many times, and today you asked him about, you know, what was the hardest thing about this situation. How did he respond to that?
Many people might know, if you've read about President Carter or listened to him talk, he has a very regimented, busy schedule that he keeps every day. You know, many times he'd wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and exercise, and then he might write part of a book, and then he would participate maybe in a breakfast or a private prayer session, and then begin the day of activities, which, you know, usually included a lot of work related to the Carter Center. And so this is someone who, even at 90 years old, is extremely busy, extremely active. And so one can imagine that stepping back from a lot of that to deal with cancer would be a dramatic change for him, particularly because he's done it for so long. So I was wondering if that might be one of the hardest challenges he might face. And while he says it will be a challenge, he wants to make sure that the treatment of this cancer takes priority for him.
And another thing that struck me, it was how upbeat he seemed. He didn't seem, you know, sad. I think he said this has been harder on his wife of so many years than it has been on himself.
Yeah, that's true. And even though he was upbeat, he kept a very positive outlook. Also, too, he was a little bit more subdued than usual. I've interviewed him many times, and in those interviews, you know, he's usually upbeat. This seemed to be a little bit more subdued than usual, but given the news and given the impact on his family and the Carter Center and him revealing a lot of this for the first time publicly, you can imagine his state of mind. But he is remarkably, again, at ease with that decision. And he said that he wants to make sure that he makes room and opportunity for this treatment to take hold and help him extend his life. And he did say that he's going to do whatever doctors recommend.
That's VOA's Kane Farabaugh speaking with my colleague Sarah Williams. Jimmy Carter is, of course, getting a lot of attention on social media today for his remarks at that news conference. Michael Lippin has been looking at that and joins us in the studio. Michael, how has the social media world reacted?
Hi, David. Well, you know, it's reacted with almost universal expressions of sympathy and support. I've seen dozens and dozens of such messages posted on Facebook and Twitter. You can see some of those on Facebook if you go to the Facebook page of the Carter Center, which posted a link to a video of the news conference. As for Twitter, all you need to do is type in Jimmy Carter's name into the search field, and you'll see even more of those kinds of messages. So many people were tweeting his name today, in fact, that it was one of the top two trending items on Twitter, both in the United States and worldwide, for part of Thursday.
Now, were there any tweets about the former president that stood out from the crowd?
I did see some, actually. I found a nice series of tweets from a reporter in Mr. Carter's home state of Georgia. That reporter, Richard Elliott, was in Mr. Carter's small hometown of Plains, Georgia, today, and he joined a group of the president's friends and family at a cafe to watch the news conference. Elliott works for WSB-TV, and his handle is @RElliottWSB. He posted several photos from inside the cafe, along with a couple of tweets, one of which read like this: "Smiles from here in Plains after friends heard Jimmy Carter say that his greatest achievement was to marry his wife, Rosalyn." Elliott also posted images of campaign-style signs popping up all over Plains, you know, like the signs that many Americans put in their yard saying, "Vote for so-and-so," or, you know, whatever the candidate's name is for president. Well, these signs said, "Jimmy Carter for cancer survivor." There was also a touching note from U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell, whose handle is @SecBurwell. She wrote, "What I've learned from working with Jimmy Carter is unrelenting tenacity and bravery. You're in our thoughts and prayers, President Carter." David?
All right. Thanks a lot, Michael. We invite your questions or comments about this story or anything you hear on our show. You can send us a tweet @VOA_IE. You can also log on to our website, www.voanews.com, and you can tweet the Carter Center. They are @CarterCenter. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
"This is a problem that inflicts almost every country."
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. An Islamic State-affiliated group has claimed responsibility for a large car bomb attack outside a state security building in Cairo early Thursday. Dozens were wounded, but no one was killed in the latest militant attack. Local officials say at least six policemen were among those hurt by the massive blast, which ripped the facade off the government building and shadowed windows, that is, of surrounding structures in the residential neighborhood of Shobra. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with RAND Corporation Middle East analyst Jeffrey Martini about the significance of the attack.
This is a little unusual for the Islamic State. Usually they go for bloodshed. What's going on here?
It is unusual. It's unusual in terms of the timing, as you mentioned, that it was at a time when the building would certainly not be occupied. It was also unusual in that it was not a suicide attack, but the perpetrator escaped. And so to me, that suggests that really the Islamic State here was going for the symbolism that they could hit a government installation in Cairo, and they weren't as concerned with the amount of damage they could do in terms of casualties.
Would you characterize this bombing in any way as any connection or a response to Egyptian President Fatah al-Sisi's campaign to round up and jail the Muslim Brotherhood? I mean, after all, they're all Islamists. Is there any connection at all?
I don't see a strong connection there. Now, to be fair to the Assisi regime, which does allege a connection between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic State, there are now elements of the Muslim Brotherhood who are on the record as adopting violence. But I see this attack and, in general, the violence in Egypt as being perpetrated by the Islamic State, not by the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think the regime overplays the intersection between those two groups, although we do not have great visibility into how many members of the Muslim Brotherhood who are disaffected may have, you know, left the Brotherhood to join the Islamic State.
This bombing also came just days after President al-Sisi signed a new anti-terrorism law, which not only broadens police powers and restricts human rights, but also affects the press with fines for those who don't hew to the official government line regarding terrorism and those who perpetrate it. Any connection with this bombing and the new terrorism law, or is this purely coincidental?
Well, in terms of the way the Islamic State is framing this in their statement, they were saying that the bombing, the timing of the bombing, was driven by their desire to have revenge for the hanging, that is, the Assisi regime prosecuted and executed by hanging several individuals from the Sinai who were accused of carrying out earlier attacks on behalf of the Islamic State. So that would suggest it's more coincidental, the idea that this would be linked to the anti-terrorism legislation, although certainly there's some rich symbolism there as well.
That is RAND Corporation Middle East analyst Jeffrey Martini speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency Thursday downplayed a media report that the UN Nuclear Oversight Group will allow Iran to carry out its own nuclear inspections as part of a multilateral accord reached last month in Vienna. The statement follows claims by the Associated Press that the draft version of a side agreement indicates Iran could use its inspectors to investigate the Parchin military base south of Tehran. My colleague Victor Beatty spoke with Ambassador James Jeffries, who served in the George W. Bush administration and is now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute on Near East Policy, about the news.
I'm increasingly of the view that this administration will do anything to avoid challenging or irritating the Iranians. They either have such a fixation on this agreement or on the bigger game of what they think is flipping Iran, that they simply are not trying to hold it to any kind of standard. This is a country that was pursuing nuclear weapons at that site. I know that. I've seen the intelligence. This is going to reverberate very, very broadly around Congress, as it should. This is worse than ignoring it. This is basically saying that their word is good. It isn't. You know what they're going to report. I'm very, very frustrated.
The White House Wednesday insisted it has confidence in the International Atomic Energy Agency after this report emerged. This is Ned Price of the National Security Council. Quote, we are confident in the agency's technical plans for investigating the possible military dimensions of Iran's former program issues that in some cases date back more than a decade.
Do they trust the ability of the Iranians to provide answers that we can use as a basis to determine the degree to which Iran was doing very sensitive and sophisticated warhead development? Now, going forward, here's the problem with this. This is, in some respects, a very intrusive inspection regime. But here's the thing. This is where this whole Parchin thing comes in. An intrusive inspection regime is no better than what the international community, read the United States, does if something is found to be amiss, wrong, potentially cheating. And that means that no matter how good the IAEA is at discovering inconsistencies, suspicions, and other things, because you never catch anybody red-handed, the issue is, what will this administration do about it?
That's Ambassador James Jeffries, a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute on Near East Policy, speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Coming up, Alexis Christophorus will tell us how a shakeup in the Greek government played in financial markets. And Jeff London takes us to Tanglewood, where there's been music in the air for 75 years now. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute. Did you know that the moon has an atmosphere? Well, it does, a very thin one. As a matter of fact, it's so thin, most scientists refer to it as an exosphere. By comparison, Earth's atmosphere at sea level is about 100 trillion times denser. Now, NASA confirms what scientists have long believed. The moon's trivial atmosphere contains neon, as discovered by the Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer, or LADEE. Not only did LADEE detect neon, it found a relatively abundant supply of the element at the moon. The NASA spacecraft also found that the moon's exosphere is made up of mostly helium, argon, and neon that came from the solar wind or was the result of radioactive decay of lunar rocks. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd. Turning to the financial page, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has resigned on the same day that his country paid $3.5 billion to the European Central Bank. The payment was possible because Greece accepted a third bailout package from the Eurozone, but it came with stringent austerity measures. Our business correspondent Alexis Christophorus says that Tsipras stepped down after accepting policies he had promised not to accept when he was elected.
Well, Tsipras submitted his resignation to President Pavlopoulos and asked for the earliest possible election date. They are now looking at holding the snap election on September 20th, with Tsipras seeking to crush a rebellion in his leftist party and seal public support for what would be the country's third bailout. Faced with the near collapse of the Greek financial system, which threatened the country's future in the euro, Tsipras was forced to accept the creditors' demands for yet more austerity and economic reform. And they are the very policies he had promised to scrap when he was elected in January.
Turning from Greece now to China, the Chinese government devalued its currency a couple of times last week in order to make it more attractive as a reserve currency and to let the market determine its value. But the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, has said, no, we don't want the yuan as a reserve currency. What does that mean for Beijing?
Right. This was really a setback on the global stage for the yuan, the IMF signaling that it will not be added to its elite basket of reserve currencies known as the special drawing rights for at least a year. And Beijing devalued the yuan in a surprise move last week, causing its biggest one-day loss in two decades and triggering a wave of criticism from U.S. lawmakers and American industries that must compete with cheaper Chinese exports. Officials in Beijing said the move was part of a plan to allow the market a greater role in exchange rates. And in fact, Goldman Sachs says the yuan will hit 6.60 per dollar over the next 12 months. Another analyst at ANZ Bank lowered its forecast for the yuan to 6.55 against the U.S. dollar by the end of the year. So it looks like there's going to be a little more bloodletting there before it hits bottom.
That's business correspondent Alexis Christophorus. Wall Street was not happy with all this. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 2%. The S&P 500 erased all the gains that it has made so far this year. On a happier subject, open-air classical music festivals have become staples of life in the United States in the summer. But 75 years ago, when the Boston Symphony first performed on a former estate called Tanglewood, it was a brand new idea. Jeff London takes us to Tanglewood, which is marking three quarters of a century of musical excellence.
When Serge Koussevitzky, the Russian-born conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, opened Tanglewood in 1937, he chose an all-Beethoven program, including the Pastorale Symphony. And when conductor Christoph von Dohnányi opened the 75th anniversary season in early July, he recreated it. Beethoven's musical tribute to nature, complete with bird calls, seems a perfect companion to the charms of Tanglewood. When you walk through the trees and open fields of the campus, you come across music everywhere. French horn players rehearsing Strauss in a cabin in the woods. A string quartet playing contemporary music on a concert hall stage. Two trumpets rehearsing Beethoven in a barn.
It's a place where music and nature come together in the most wonderfully natural way.
Conductor John Williams has composed many of the most famous movie scores. He's been coming to Tanglewood every summer since 1980, when he was named music director of the Boston Pops.
We learn something about ourselves as musicians and as listeners out here every day when we're here among the trees and the beautiful weather and so on.
Boston Symphony Managing Director Mark Volpe oversees the 1,000 employees and volunteers at Tanglewood from a Victorian house on the property.
Every city has a concert hall. What makes the Boston Symphony absolutely unique in the world of orchestras is Tanglewood. Tanglewood really is the granddaddy of this notion of a summer venue.
One recent weekend, Greg Passan came up from New York City, a three-hour drive, to meet friends, have a picnic, and listen to some Beethoven.
It's relaxed, but it feels very, not formal, but ritualized in a way, right? People are coming with their chairs and their tables and their bottles of wine, and clearly it's something they do all the time and have very specific ways of doing it, and so it's the social aspect as well as the musical.
Some have been coming for decades, like Bob Rosenblatt. A World War II veteran, his first visit was in 1947. He's been a volunteer usher for 40 years.
Every concert's my first. Doesn't it sound Pollyannish? But it's true.
Tanglewood officially celebrated its 75th anniversary with a gala concert featuring Yo-Yo Ma, John Williams, and James Taylor, among others. There will be more gala evenings during the summer in the Berkshires. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in Lenox, Massachusetts.
Thanks for joining us for VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. G. Abby Lee directed our program. Zineb Abdulrahman was our engineer. Thanks for listening.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously, the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including the Voice of America. Under his leadership, the group has kidnapped hundreds of children to serve as hostages, bearers, and even fighters, most recently in the northeastern town of Damasak. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Sikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shiku. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the Rewards for Justice tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.